Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 180.PR2314, certificate number 46116. The caning of Charles Sumner.
In the name of the Constitution, which has been outraged, of the laws trampled down, of justice banished, of humanity degraded, of peace destroyed, of freedom crushed to earth, and in the name of the Heavenly Father, whose service is freedom, I make this last appeal.
Now we, you know, you and I like to, on this program, really teach the controversy. We like to tell both sides of any story.
Of every story. And maybe there's more than two sometimes.
Sometimes there's multiple sides. Sometimes there are seven sides.
It could be a whole Rashomon situation going on in Charles Sumner's chambers.
No, in the case of Charles Sumner, I think I'm going to at least give a little preview of the show. We're going to come down on one side of this issue. We typically do not teach both sides of the American Civil War without generally preferring a side, and that's how this show is going to go. We're gonna choose sides.
Well, clearly we're pro union and abolition,
as
I believe we have unfailingly been.
That's right. I still believe
strongly
in the abolition
abolitionist
of slavery. Yes,
we're fighting for that cause
globally.
But are you saying we're also pro caning?
No, that's the thing. The caners in this situation are maybe predictably on the wrong side of the issue.
I see. So it's not even a tough choice. You're not like, well, like I hate slavery, but I wouldn't cane a sitting senator for it. But in this case, you can have your cake and eat it too. You can be against slavery and
against caning.
Okay, good.
Well, and this is, I mean, you're not wrong that this is part of our national dialogue now, and maybe the global dialogue. Is it okay to cane a senator if you disagree with them politically? Let's say it's a bad senator. How do you feel about caning them? Well, and by caning, I mean, just for futurelings that live in a sort of ethereal future.
Without canes?
Without even knowing what a cane is. None of them use a cane either because they are infirm or as a style element.
I don't like this ableist view of the future where, you know, we don't have the amazing differences offered by canes and, in fact, sword canes.
I was using a cane last night, as a matter of fact, but as a style element. And then as the night wore on, my legs and my knees got tired, and then it became a practical
You're
element.
Like, I was like, at first I liked this skull on the head of my cane, but now...
Now I really like the support it offers.
Wait, was this your Halloween costume?
Oh, you're giving it away that we're recording this show in the Halloween era.
It's Happy All Saints Day, by the way.
Thank you.
What are you going to do for All Saints Day?
Well, I celebrate the entire catalog of All Saints.
Yeah, all the saints. Yeah. There's a lot of saints, and we only have 24 hours to get to them.
Oh, I thought you were talking about All Saints,
the band.
The band, yeah.
Yeah, today's the day we celebrate All Saints.
Yes, last night, so, you know, I had a pretty good Halloween costume. I've got a little stockpile of them, right? I have a
yeah.
Very...
You're wearing one like pretty much every time I see you. But you mean intentional Halloween costumes?
I earned that. Yeah, I have a giant rabbit suit, right, which works at Easter, but also if you're celebrating somebody's sober birthday, but also on Halloween.
It could be, if it's a pink one, it could be for Christmas too, right? Because you've got your whole Ralphie world of, it's not pink though, is it?
No, but when I was walking, down the street in my rabbit costume a couple of days ago.
What, you were?
And a guy coming the other way.
Was it Elmer Fudd? Because look out.
It was not. That would have been great. No, it was like a sort of portly, slightly younger version of myself. Shorter, chubbier, bigger beard.
Wow. This is a real Spider-Man Into the Multiverse moment.
It was in a pink rabbit costume. And we saw each other at a distance. And of course, what is there to do but run and embrace?
Did you?
Yes. We gave one another a big embrace. But then I think he felt like, well, now that we've done this, what else is there to do?
Well, plus you're dressed as rabbit, so he might not want to do the next thing.
Well, there it is. To do. There it is. So, and I was like, no, we should just, you know, sit here and rub tummies. And he was like, well, I have other places to be. I'm late for an appointment.
I have eggs to hide.
And I was like, golly, all right, sure. But in addition to that, you know, I have...
He was going to some furry convention, and he thought you were a poser.
I was like, it's Halloween. And he was like, not for me. Yeah, I live this every day.
This is a Thursday. I'm just going to get cabbages from Mr. McGregor's garden.
That was the thing. My daughter kept accusing me of being a furry.
Just because you were wearing a giant rabbit suit. The injustice.
And I said, the thing I'm missing is the face mask.
Oh, that's true.
Right? If you're a furry, you're really like inhabiting the character behind the fake nose. And it was just me and my beardy face out there. I don't think the ears and the tail.
That's good. You have no identity to hide. You're not getting up to any.
Yeah, well, I'm a big rabbit.
Any mischief.
But then I also have, you know, like not an entire suit of chainmail, but the necessary pieces of chainmail.
Enough. Just the normal middle class amount of chainmail.
Yeah, I mean, if you live a life as long as I have and you haven't picked up a couple of items of chainmail, I don't know what you've been doing. And then I have a variety of capes and robes and, you know, cloaks.
You're basically an elderly gay actor.
Yeah, who's lived for 150 years.
Which cape do I wear tonight?
It is kind of like I've been alive for a couple hundred years and just keep trying to introduce a new generation of people to the fact that, no, I'm just a regular, normal 50-year-old, not a 250-year-old.
I noticed I'm so far on the other end of this spectrum that I noticed the other night opening our drawer of funny hats and costumes to see if there was anything in there that would work for me. I realized that the dogs have better costumes than I do. Like in that drawer, I could turn one of my dogs into a stegosaurus and one of my dogs into a lion, and there was nothing I would wear.
I mean, is your drawer of costumes just like, there's a bow tie?
It's like it was the kids' little dress-up drawer. Oh, so it's a lot of... It's a lot of...
I mean, we're sitting in a room that's only one-third of my daughter's dress-up.
Yeah, I was about to say, there's like a witch's hat right in my line of sight as I'm talking to you.
The idea that you have all your kids' dress-up stuff in a drawer is just so, like, astonishing to me.
You've got six Imelda Marcos rooms.
I do. Just for my own stuff.
Was your daughter standing right there and someone threw water on her? Because now there's...
That's not there's even the hat. Only witch's hat in this room. But yeah, so my costume last night was, I have this like really scary kind of wolf mask, but it's only the top half of the mask, like the bottom half, it's just a upper, but it's got ears and stuff and it blends perfectly with my hair and beard. So when I put it on, it's hard to tell where the mask ends and my actual face begins enough that there's an uncanny valley problem.
You're a Cronenberg thing.
It's super scary. And I know it's scary because it actually, like, I get reactions out of teen boys. Teen boys that are out on Halloween with no costume on, just like, hey, what's up?
Who's got full-size candy bars?
Yeah, and then they come around the corner and they see me and they all jump out of their skin. And so I play up to it by just standing quietly. I don't respond. When people talk to me or ask questions, I just look at them.
That's the new horror aesthetic.
It's the worst.
Jumping out from behind a door is like... 70s slasher movie. Today you just want someone tall standing in the corner.
That's the thing.
Gazing balefully.
So on Halloween, I've started just, because my daughter still likes to trick or treat, but I'll just post up in a shadow somewhere, standing there in a long velvet cape, cloak with a hood, and my wolf mask, and then my sword cane, and I just stand there and let people find me, and it's terrible. It's really a terrible prank.
But really, what are you? What is that costume?
It's just wolf. Something you don't want to see.
Wolf guy.
Because I'm big, you know, and it just seems like that's something's wrong. It's just, it's uncanny valley, right? There's just enough wrong with each element of it that it combines in the dark to feel very bad. Very, very bad for people.
That's great.
Yeah.
It's you don't have a concept. What are you going as this year? Well...
Something scary.
Hold on. Turn off the lights and I'll show you.
Oh, I'm just going as creepy hands. Ah. But I, you know, I tried to carry a cane. The problem is it's just like smoking a pipe. If you're not in They Might Be Giants, like what are you can't past 1980, you can't really smoke a pipe. And there's no reason to carry a decorative cane. You've just got too many other things to carry, right? Canes are from a time when you didn't have to also carry a phone. And
what you need is a tip for your cane where you can like be looking at your phone.
There it is, right. The head of your cane is your phone.
I guess I just invented the selfie stick. But I feel like you're going to age into an age pretty soon where when you're old enough, you are from all eras.
Yeah.
And then you can, somebody will be like, well, of course he has a pipe. He's an old man, and nobody will think, but wait, he was born in around 1970. Why does he have a pipe? Why does he have a cane?
Yeah, I think...
Because old people are from all times.
That's right. And I think all culture now is from all times, and no one understands any of it. So, you know, you see people in Mario Brothers costumes on Halloween, and there are people going, wow, classic! Like, Mario Brothers feels like something that might have happened in the 1860s. Some young people.
Is Mario now a thing? Like, I was downtown and I saw 30 Marios like it was SantaCon.
Me too. There are Marios everywhere.
What are they doing?
I don't know. I don't know.
Seems disrespectful to the true Mario.
I don't know.
Maybe they're like Marios like Saddam Hussein doubles, like he fears assassination.
The real Mario is somewhere and yeah. He sent out his legions.
I probably saw the real Mario. I just couldn't tell because he had so many doppelgangers.
That's a spicy meatball. I don't understand what kids are. I saw a dozen costumes that I was like, I don't know. It's got to be a video game, I guess. An anime.
Good job being from an anime I've never heard of.
It means something to you, and that's really what this holiday is all about. It's all about you, young people.
My kid and their friends dressed as Muppet Show Muppets.
Which ones?
Well,
I know every Muppet Show.
First three that came over to the party were Beaker, Dr. Bunsen, Honeydew, and Janice. But they had
there you go.
But they had kind of dressed as humans trying to get across a vibe of Beakerness or Janice-ness.
Oh.
So it was like if you had asked a generative AI, like, I'm a freak. Show me Janice as a human girl because I'm a huge weirdo.
Right. Make Beaker into a human.
Beaker, but a guy I could hang out with.
No. No, thank you.
It was good.
Scary.
See, that's your subtly wrong. It's a human Beaker standing in a corner just looking at you.
It's one of the worst things about AI is its ability to do things like that, where it's like, make the Pope in a bathtub with naked Jack Black. And you're like, no, don't ask computers to do that because the computer will remember it.
In the past, you would have to write two checks to get that picture. One larger than the other.
You just have to donate to the charity. Yeah, that's right. Choice.
Knights of Columbus. $500.
In this show, yeah, we have traditionally been pro-union, I think, right? In the American Civil War.
But we're just bandwagon fans. The Union won.
The Union won.
And then we're like, yeah, we were always for the Union.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. And I mean your frontier ancestors, where did they tried to get away from the whole Civil War controversy by going up to a great plateau.
On my mom's side, on my dad's side, it's Texas-Oklahoma border.
Oh, yeah.
It's
that's tough.
It's Southerners.
Tough There's turf.
There are Confederate soldiers and sadly slave owners in that line.
Well, and that is the region that kind of precipitated this this event in American history. And I should, we're going to give a little history lesson here, unlike most episodes of Omnibus. But we're going to talk about, just laying some groundwork here, the Missouri Compromise. How familiar are you with the Missouri Compromise? I know.
AP U.S. history.
I know.
No, I can do this.
Okay,
Missouri's going to get statehood, but the problem is that's an extra slave state, or is this Kansas, Nebraska?
That's, you know, Kansas, Nebraska Act.
Damn it. So this is not California joining the Union.
No.
Okay. So this is,
Ooh, boy. Yeah, it's a tough one.
Is it statehood for Missouri? Is that what happens?
Missouri is enters the Union as a slave state,
right?
And so, Maine.
Oh, Maine
is a free state.
Well, that's what I was going for, but I had the state wrong.
Yeah,
it was Maine.
It was Maine.
We should be called the Maine Compromise. Why do we have to pick the slave state?
Oh, good point. Well, you know, it was the problem was always with the slave states, right? The problem at this point.
I see. Yeah. So by blaming the slave state,
yeah,
that's actually the woker nomenclature.
Well, let's say that, right? Although the slave states at the time were very proud of themselves, and they would have been happy to, it the Missouri Compromise too.
I'm just saying, your country can either get Maine or Missouri. What do you draft first? You draft Maine. That's not hard.
Well, Maine at the time, 1820.
Yeah, but you should be able
bunch
to
of moose.
You should be able to see an embryo. All those beautiful pine forests.
Sure.
There's lobsters and lighthouses up here.
Yeah, that's true. But Missouri's right in the thick of it.
Missouri's got river access.
Yeah, and it's part of the whole. I mean, Missouri's the gateway to the Louisiana Purchase. True. I mean, it's a lot.
Like in
going
1950,
on
you'd draft Maine, but in 1850, you probably won't Missouri.
You're headed west. You're not headed north. Canada's up there. That's a hard border.
Canada's a dead end.
Yeah. No. You're trying to get out to the middle, and Missouri's the keystone of this, right in the middle.
The middle's not that great. You're trying to get to California. You have to go through the middle,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
to get someplace good.
I mean, the problem is in the United States.
They used to call them, they didn't have flyover states. They just called them wagon over states.
Wagon over states. We weren't even out. We weren't even trying to get to California in 1820. It was just a dream. It was a Spanish dream then.
But, like, I think people were like, that's a good dream.
I mean, it's a pretty good dream.
There's gold in Zorro.
Not there. Yet. There wasn't gold then. God hadn't made gold in California until the 1840s.
There wasn't even Zorro, probably.
There might have been Zorro. I don't know.
Does Zorro predate gold?
The historic record is mute on Zorro in California in the 1820s. The problem in the United States, and I'm saying this mostly for futurelings who live in a post-United States world or Australians and English and French people listening to the show now. We had what was called the Three-Fifths Compromise in the U.S., which was that the slave states really recognized that for the purposes of electing members of the House of Representatives, it was a great advantage to them to have the population of slaves represented in apportioning how many representatives you had.
You don't want them to have actual citizenship in any meaningful way, but you want them as a population voting block.
You did.
They can't vote.
And the northern states saw this as a wonderful opportunity to say to the South, no, you can't use slaves as citizens if you don't give them the rights of citizens. And so this terrible compromise, which was that we would, for the purposes of electing apportioning, you know, members of the House of Representatives, the southern states could count slaves as 3/5 of a person.
And this dates back to the Constitution. This is a stumbling block in planning the Republic. Mm-hmm. This dates back to 1787.
And that was every one of these compromises at the time. There were certain supporters of them that felt like, look, this is a real controversy in the United States. Some of the states want slaves, and a lot of them don't, and we just can't get together on this. Why don't we come up with a compromise, and that'll just take this off the table, and we can call it solved.
This is the same tactic you see moderates taking today, right? Like, the New York Times editorial page has been like, well, I mean, some people think you should overthrow the government if you don't like the election. Some people don't.
Mm-hmm.
What's the middle way here?
Well, if you are following the news in Israel and Palestine for the last 70 years, there's always somebody that's like, why can't we just meet in the middle with a solution that solves nothing and makes no one happy?
I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah. So the challenge the challenge, of course, is that slavery is an abomination and you cannot compromise right. with it. You can't have
The middle way is an abomination too.
Yeah, there's no like, oh, I've got a solution.
3/5. I love it. Everyone will be happy.
But the problem with the United States is, and one of the things that makes the country great is that there is this constant push and pull between is this a confederation of states or is it a powerful centrally governed community of lesser entities, right? Or does the power come from the states themselves? So what the Missouri Compromise did, in addition to bringing Missouri in as a slave state and Maine as a free state, was it established the border of 36 degrees north, 3630 north, as a line across the middle of the United States, and no new states that entered above that line would be slave states. It was a border.
What is that line in practice? Is that like the northern border of Missouri today, or does it go through Missouri?
No,
or?
Missouri is the one thing above it. So
it's basically the Missouri-Arkansas border?
Yeah, and so basically everything above Oklahoma to the west could not be a slave state. Everything below it, which would have been Arizona, New Mexico, and Southern California, potentially could be admitted as slave states. But this was a great threat to the southern states because as westward expansion in the United States started to, you know, be where all the energy was, they saw the potential for there to be a great number of free states entering the Union, and then it would disempower the South.
This idea is a little bit insane, by the way, that the South, you know, if your justification for slavery is that it's your special institution based on your cotton economy, it's not really clear why you would care if Arizona had that special, except to keep your legitimacy alive.
Right? Well, and what it was there were 11 slave states and 11 free states. Mm. And so each new state that entered the Union, the southern states felt like for every one, there should be an opposite one. Otherwise, we're going to lose this crucial balance, this like peacekeeping balance between, you know, the two forms of economics or whatever it was, you know. But it had a lot more to do with, as we've seen in past depictions of the South and their own self-image. This was really the era, the first half of the 19th century, the era when the South really was digging into the sort of chivalrous culture.
We're the aristocrats. We're the closest thing to Europe you're going to get on this godforsaken continent.
And we're the ones who truly, you know, practice. And there are so many analogs to today. You don't, I think, in America right now, feel like the South is presenting itself as the culture of chivalry as much. But that it was that the idea that it's the old way is the best way,
we represent tradition.
That's right.
The funny thing is that 1111 illusion conceals the fact that the population of the Union was almost 20 million at the time of the Civil War, and the South was like less than half of that.
Yes, right, and
like so they're propping up their very particular regional. What did you say? Abomination on the basis of, despite the fact that they're, you know, it's like today, it's a third of the country is crazy.
And it also like today, the difficulties in having a bicameral legislature where there are two senators per state and then a much larger group of representatives, the Three-Fifths Compromise allowed the southern states to have a much disproportionate representation, right, in the legislature.
Just like today.
But the senators at that time were appointed by state legislators.
Oh, yeah.
Or state legislatures. So the cause of anti-slavery had gotten into the state legislatures of a kind of plurality of states, so that the Senate was reliably abolitionist and the House was this kind of, you know, like it's rabid.
It's the opposite of today,
yeah,
right?
And this was...
17th Amendment is 1913, yeah, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
Direct election of senators, not till 1913.
Isn't that crazy?
It's nuts.
We'll see some weird legislature stuff here in a second, but it became clear, and this was also a period when the Native American tribes of the East had all been pushed into the middle of the country as part of the Trail of Tears process. And so the Plains states now had a lot of displaced tribes, the Delaware and so forth, who now were like, oh, your new reservation is out here in horse country. You may have formerly lived in Alleghenies, but you know, this is your new place
worse for you.
But as settlement moved that way, and it was clear that this was going to be these were going to be the next states. The Missouri Compromise became like a point of real inflammation in the country because the South recognized that that all the new states were basically going to be free states.
The South is madder about
them. They're really mad. So in the 1850s, the discovery of gold in California, the acquisition of territory that came about as a result of the war with Mexico.
Oh, of course, it's the Compromise of 1850. That's what I was thinking of, not the Missouri. Okay, that makes more sense.
Yeah, it's all...
Discovery of gold.
It's all like focusing American attention on the West. And a senator from Illinois by the name of Stephen Douglas... that we know from the Lincoln-Douglas debates.
Spoilers.
Stephen Douglas had a real interest in building a railroad across the United States. And what he wanted to do was build the railroad from his state of Illinois, from Chicago, to California. And he saw that in order to do that, he was going to need to, well, that the area of Kansas and Nebraska were going to be... incorporated into the Union. They were the next logical places for new states to arise. And in order to get his railroad built, he wanted to admit these states, but they were both north
of the line.
And so the South was agitated that, well, if you admit two new free states, then the balance of the Missouri Compromise is destroyed. The country will go off its rails, and they're all rattling their sabers because they all had sabers then.
They were literally rattling sabers.
And Stephen Douglas wants to keep the peace, and he's a compromiser, and he's really interested mostly in building his railroad. And so he introduces the idea that we should repeal the Missouri Compromise and let new states that enter the Union decide the question of slavery by virtue of popular sovereignty. This is the states' rights mentality, right? The federal government should not be dictating, and there's plenty of precedent in U.S. politics up to this point.
Yeah.
This question of whether the federal government can dictate whether or not a state is free or slave.
So once again, kicking the can.
Kick the can down the road. He was hoping this was a compromise that would allow, who can argue? Like the residents of this new state?
Yeah.
Well. So
of course
what
they should decide.
What happened was Kansas immediately became the focal point of like a national migration.
People flood in hopes of tipping the scales.
Right. People from Missouri flooding into Kansas to make it a slave state. People from Massachusetts and Pennsylvania hitching their wagons and heading out to...
Well, you have to wonder what their plan was. Like, how long are we going to live out here, honey? Like, are we just going to vote and then head back? Or are we going to sell the house in Boston?
When you think about, like, just the kind of energy in the country at the time, it really does resonate with the energy that we have now in the sense that people were thinking really in short-term terms.
How do we stack this election?
Yeah, and how are... And very much like... meeting on the streets in Kansas in little towns who also, by the way, like meeting in just recently created reservations full of Native Americans who were new there anyway and like, oh, actually, we're going to push you further further out of here because this is, we have new issues here.
This is the story of the, we talked about it in that Osage episode, right? They had land in Kansas, and then as soon as somebody actually wanted that land in Kansas, they were like, you know what? We're going to buy our own plot. We're done with this game.
And this was, you know, the new Scorsese movie about Oklahoma. This is, those tribes ended up in Oklahoma. And it's the rare instance where nobody was trying to move to Kansas because of gold or coal or great weather.
They were excited for the civic chance to vote.
That's right. They were excited to,
in
to
many cases,
stuff
to vote,
the ballot box.
To vote for the right to enslave other human beings.
So it created what Stephen Douglas did not expect, which was nobody cared about his railroad anymore or where it went. They were
too busy shooting each other in Kansas, shooting up saloons in Kansas. Right?
They were. And the author of what became the Kansas-Nebraska Act, the two authors were Stephen Douglas, and in order to make it a true compromise, he partnered with a Southern senator, Andrew Butler of South Carolina, and they wrote this new Kansas-Nebraska Act, which basically repealed the Missouri Compromise and set in motion what became Bloody Kansas.
Does the Kansas-Nebraska Act enshrine this idea that there's going to be a popular vote per state admission, or?
That's the new truth.
Okay.
Right? And this was at a time when westward expansion was what everybody understood. I mean, it was before, I think both sides of the slavery debate were very aware that the country was on the verge of splitting. And a lot of the abolitionists in the North wanted to get rid of the South, wanted the South out of the country even more passionately than the South wanted to become its own nation. The idea just being that we have a civilized country here, and
the way to solve this problem is not to retrain the other part.
Yeah.
We'll just jettison it.
We're a modern industrial nation, and these people in the South are basically 18th century. They have 18th century morals, and let's be done with them. So the Kansas-Nebraska Act started a rage nationally, and a senator from Massachusetts. This was a time when you could get up and give a speech on the Senate floor that lasted more than a day. You could give a speech that lasted a day, and then everyone would go home, and you'd come back and begin your speech again.
Would the chamber be empty the way it is today? You know, on C-SPAN, they'll cut to the empty, you know, some guy's haranguing and they'll cut to the empty seats. Or do you think people actually stuck around to hear these day-long speeches?
You know, people have to go to the bathroom and eat lunch no matter what era. I mean, speaking as a 250-year-old, we've always had to use the restroom at various times.
A lot. And, you know, the average senator is, when I was a kid, the average senator was 40 years older than me. And now, today, the average senator is still 40 years older than me.
But this was in May of 1856. And Charles Sumner, you know, if you think about Washington, D.C. in August, that I bet you the room is empty. But in May, it's nice there.
Are there, like, do people have a day's worth of things to say? I mean, this is not any kind of tactic, filibuster-like tactic. It's not a delaying maneuver, right? He just is an impassioned orator.
It's what made Lincoln's Gettysburg Address something we still remember because it was
nice and short.
It was just 1 3x5 card in an era when people would stand up. I mean, Lincoln and Douglas debated these issues multiple times. And in fact, one of the oldest books I own is a little set of very tattered books that belonged to my great-great-grandfather. And it was like the bound Lincoln Douglas debates.
It's the transcripts of the debates.
Where people, I guess, in Ohio in the 1860s really like wanted to sit of an evening over the fire and read them aloud.
The first podcast.
But they would, I mean, some of those Lincoln Douglas debates, each of the two men would speak for 3 hours. Like one of them would speak for 3 hours and then the other would get up for a rebuttal. So the audience is clearly used to sitting for 6 hours and listening to people talk about the economics and morality of slavery.
Again, if you don't have TV.
That's right. I mean, nobody's looking at their phone.
Yeah, I think Lincoln spoke after another very long orator had spoken for hours.
Right.
And people loved that he I mean, to this day, there's nothing better than going to the theater and opening the playbill and seeing the play will be 80 minutes with no intermission. You're like, yes, I just got an hour of my life back.
So Sumner gets up and he gives a speech. And in the course of giving this speech, he's ripping on everyone. He's ripping on the South.
Sumner is a senator from
Massachusetts. Okay. And it's basically a diss track, right? He's standing up there saying, this is immoral. It's unconscionable.
He's one of the most rock ribbed abolitionists in the Senate.
He really is. And he is, he ends up, and we'll talk about his distinguished career after this event, but, he's not sparing any vitriol against his opponents, and he addresses Andrew Butler, co-author of the Kansas-Nebraska Act. He addresses him directly, and he says, "The senator," or I mean, he addresses him in that senatorial style where he talks about him in the third person. "The senator from South Carolina has read many books of chivalry and believes himself a chivalrous knight with sentiments of honor and courage." Now, he gets into a little bit of slut-shaming here.
Uh-oh. Are we going to cancel Charles Sumner?
"Of course, he has chosen a mistress to whom he has made his vows, and who, though ugly to others," so there's also a little bit of like ugly shaming, "though ugly to others, is always lovely to him."
This is, this is the kind of thing where people are like, this is an unprecedented breach of Senate etiquette, and it'll just be somebody in the State of the Union stands up and goes, "No, you're wrong." Whereas like 150 years ago, you would literally get up and be like, "My distinguished colleague has an extremely ugly horse-faced wife." And everyone would just be like, "You got him, Senator."
Well, what was interesting in the public dialogue at the time was that the sexualization of slaves and of slavery as part of the debate was very prevalent.
Oh, really? So people in the North were like, "You sickos, just have a weird thing for your slaves."
And they would say this as a form of grave insult to their Southern colleagues. And in the newspapers, editorials would talk about the slavery issue and use very not coded at all, like very broad language about how slaveholders, slave owners were creeps. And they kept slaves because they were debauched, and they had relationships with their slaves that were carnal and non-consensual.
But the history bears all this out. That, you know, calling slave owner slavers rapists is not ahistorical. But would they have used language that we disagree with today? Because they're also saying, and clearly, you know, no one should be touching the other races with a 10-foot pole.
No, it was the other way, that the Southern response, the riposte to this, was that the Northern senators were in love with African Americans.
Oh, I see.
That they didn't. That it wasn't right. That they wanted to free them. It was that they were infatuated with them and wanted
you got a sick thing for them.
Yeah, you're the sickos who love them so much.
You want to free them, and then maybe you want to go on a little date with them.
Yeah, exactly.
And give them flowers.
What are you going to do? Have them be citizens, and then you could get married to them. So that was the level of, but of course, florid language.
Yeah.
But both sides tried to weaponize the mysterious sexuality of black people as a way of censuring the other, or rather insulting the other with their purient desire. But so
you think that slavery would be bad enough on its own?
No,
apparently
no.
Not.
It's also very sexy. So he's talking about Butler's mistress here, but his mistress, though polluted in the sight of the world, is chaste in his sight. I mean the harlot, slavery.
Oh, it's a little twist.
Yes, it's slavery that is that's the slut here being shamed.
I came around on this argument.
For her, his tongue is always profuse in words. Do you see how dirty this is? This is dirty talk.
Yeah.
Let her be impeached in character, or any proposition made to shut her out from the extension of her wantonness, and no extravagance of manner or hardihood of assertion is then too great for this senator.
You have to wonder how extemporaneous this stuff is. Like, to us, it sounds so composed and complicated that you'd think, well, there's, you know, clearly he's written up 20 tight minutes on slavery as a harlot. But maybe this is just the kind of thing that can flood out of this guy because he's used to hour-long stump speeches and sermons about the abolitionist cause.
I think that's the crazy thing is how much of this is freestyling. And once you get in the rhythm of that language, you could see how it's just as easy to extemporize because it's so many turns of phrase. If you reduced it grammatically down to, if you diagrammed this sentence,
yeah,
you would have this whole section of very florid adjectives over here. And then really the sentence is like, he's an ass. That's what they all end up saying. Well, this was regarded as like a grave, not just a series of grave insults, but despite the florid language, like a low broadside, the type of thing only a man of low breeding would say about another.
Is it like there would be today lots of pro-clutching about the high standards of the Senate and how dare you bring that kind of gutter talk into this chamber? And
yes, exactly that. And the kind of sexual innuendo. Yeah.
That in particular.
All of this is just,
should not be in the congressional record.
Certainly a breach of, certainly scandalous even in the Northern newspapers. But the South, which is now really, really girding itself with all of the pomp and circumstance of their chivalrous age.
Their honor culture.
They love to take umbrage. And in this case, they take significant umbrage at this speech. And Northern senators recognize that this language is so inflammatory that in fact, it's almost an incitement to violence.
Even for his allies, has Sumner crossed a line here?
Well, not a rhetorical line in the sense that they all support him, but that they're issuing cautions, like,
yeah, like,
but good sir, like, mind your tongue. You're going to feel the consequences of this. Well, a younger member of the House of Representatives, by the name of Preston Brooks, who happens to be Andrew Butler's first cousin once removed, decides that this is an insult to the state of South Carolina, an insult to his cousin that demands redress. And he goes to some colleagues and says, like, I want to challenge him to a duel. What are the rules of dueling? And of course, dueling by this point is really out of fashion, against the law. And so the question of, he wants to go through this elaborate sort of Alexander Hamilton, even then it was out of fashion, but this style of like, slap him with a kid glove. And
it's funny that he's a young guy who's like, hey, what about dueling?
Well, and that's what you always see, right?
He's not aware of the...
But Reddit is full of these guys, like, who would challenge somebody to a duel even now. Yeah. And he consults with a fellow representative by the name of Lawrence Kite. The two of them decide that Sumner is lower than a dog, beneath their dignity, and that dueling is only a thing that should exist or transpire between members of the same rank.
That's convenient.
And because Brooks is a member of the House of Representatives and Sumner is a very prominent senator, you might argue that the difference in rank goes the other way. But they decide that Sumner is not worthy of being challenged to a duel.
I did not remember that Brooks was not in the Senate.
No.
So this is bringing in the other great divide in American government, which is how much the Senate hates the House and vice versa.
That's right. And so Brooks and Kite and a third friend, a Virginia legislator by the name of Henry Edmondson, it takes them a couple of days. The speech has been published in the newspapers. It's been read by multiple, it's been read across the country. It's what anybody's talking about. And the three of them arrive at the Senate on May 22nd, now fully 2 days after the speech. And they wait until the session is over and until the room empties out. And Sumner is sitting there at his desk. And Brooks walks over and in a low voice says something to the effect of, "I've read your speech, sir, sir," and it's an, you know, and it's an affront to the great state of Carolina and to my blood relative, and I will stand this indignity no longer, and hits him with a gold-tipped cane made out of gutta percha, which is a...
It's like rubber, right?
It's a, well, it's a...
It's an early proto-rubber?
Yeah, it's sort of a proto... It's a plastic, what's called a thermoplastic. There's a tree in Malaysia called a percha tree, and gutta percha is kind of a, like a... We still use it in root canals. It's a, it's like a, yeah, it's a proto-plastic. And it was a, it was... Like so the hard and so elegant cane.
The cane's not wood. It's made of this.
It's made of gutta percha. Yeah.
It's made of this latexy stuff.
So this would have been, you know, like a high class sort of decorative cane material.
If it's got a gold tip, the gold end,
the gold handle,
the gold is probably on the end that Brooks is holding. He's whacking him with his, with the gutta percha stuff, not with the metal end.
Well, he whacks him with the cane until the cane breaks into multiple pieces, and whoa, then continues to whack him with the gold handle. After the cane is broken, he grabs the, you know, or he retains the top portion that has the handle, and he continues to beat him with the handle.
And this is on the floor of the Senate? He's at his little desk in the Senate? He's not back in chamber somewhere?
No, he's at his desk, and unfortunately, the way the desks are arranged at that time, the desk is bolted to the floor. And the seats that are that go with each desk are actually like on sliders. Hmm. They're also kind of bolted to the floor. They're not, you can't just pick up a chair, maybe because they didn't want people to pick up chairs and hit one another with them. But it's on a slider, so you can slide back from your desk or slide forward. And unfortunately, Sumner falls under his desk and kind of gets trapped between the chair and the desk and can't get away. And Brooks, so Edmondson and Keat are both there.
These are Brooks's allies?
These are his two allies. And they're holding off the senators that are trying to come to his aid. And Lawrence Keat even has a pistol. And they're saying, leave them be, you know, let these men resolve their differences as one stands over the other and continues to pummel him until the cane is broken, until he's, you know, drenched in blood the whole time.
Seems like it could be fatal.
And
Sumner is a, let's see, he's born in 1811. He's a 50-something-year-old man. No, 40-something-year-old man here. He's in his mid-40s.
Preston Brooks is in his late 30s. I mean, he's not a young man, but a younger man.
Yeah.
And Brooks just keeps after him until he's, I mean, it could very well have been fatal. It resulted in serious brain trauma that that Sumner suffered from for the rest of his life. And it took him 3 years to recuperate from this. Eventually, he was dragged away by other senators, and
Brooks was
Brooks held off his, you know, didn't deliver a fatal blow, but felt like I guess he had said all he could say with the gold tip of his cane. The shattered remnants of the cane were gathered by his friend Edmondson and became talismans for Southern senators and representatives. They turned the little shattered remains of the cane into little gutta percha rings, which they would wear on chains around their neck.
It's very funny to me that it's not a wood cane. He's doing this with basically a early plastic. I guess it probably hurt a lot because it probably has a lot more
flex.
More flex, right? Like when you're, you know.
And yet brittle enough that it would break all apart.
So nobody at the time, he was lauded as a hero for standing up to
by the South, and of course this was an affront to all law-abiding citizens. So he was brought up on charges. He was arrested for assault, fined $300. There was a movement in the House of Representatives to oust him, and so what he did was resign. And then they held an immediate sort of referenda in South Carolina, and he was reelected overwhelmingly and returned to the House of Representatives, so thereby skirting the punishment of being expelled.
It's just like today. You can pretty much do anything in the House. or the Senate, actually. Like, between Santos and Menendez, like, it's very hard to get kicked out of the House or the Senate.
Well, Sumner then went back to Massachusetts and spent, again, 3 years recuperating. And Massachusetts reelected him the following year, although he wasn't able to sit in the chamber.
Oh, wow.
And kept the seat empty for the next 3 years in symbolic protest against the event. It then was the source. This event was the source of now a lot of energy back and forth from between the North and the South of trying to use shame and chivalry as weapons against one another. So there was a representative from Massachusetts named Anson Burlingame, who tried to insult Brooks enough that Brooks would have no choice but to challenge him to a duel.
Uh-huh.
Because the rules of dueling stated that if Brooks challenged him to a duel, he could pick the weapons and the location, and Burlingame just happened to be a crack marksman. And so Brooks did challenge him, was forced by chivalry to challenge him, and Burlingame picked rifles, and he set the location at on the Canadian side of the Niagara Falls to get away from American laws against. And so then Brooks was really shamed by the fact that he refused to.
He
said, I won't go up there because, you know, I can't travel through the North safely without putting my life in jeopardy. So there was a lot of this kind of what are you going to do about it type of posturing. But as you know, I think, and as our listeners probably know, none of these compromises averted the Civil War, the coming war.
Spoilers.
And in fact, the caning of Charles Sumner became, I guess you could say, was really the lit fuse.
I mean, it's kind of the first skirmish of the war in a way, right? Like, that's the moment when it maybe seems unbacked down fromable. If literal elected congressmen are like nearly killing each other in the halls of government, like, that's a very hard genie to put back in the bottle.
Yeah, there's a lot of you can make a really good case that the violence in Kansas.
Yeah.
Of people flooding in there to determine whether or not Kansas was a free or slave state. That was the beginning of the war.
Yeah, there were hundreds of deaths there, too.
Yeah. But this was a place where now the rhetoric had become physical violence. And exactly, because the northern newspapers all said, oh, well, now we aren't free to speak without risking that the Southerners come into the chamber and beat our heads. Is that truly the nation we want to live in? And people forget that a lot of the Southern secession was welcomed by Northern abolitionists, and this was part of this argument. There was a lot written at the time, like, kick them out, kick the South out of the country.
Are they playing the long game that the war is inevitable? Like, the sooner this starts to happen, the sooner slavery is banned on the continent, or are they just like, let them do their own thing in their own country?
I feel like the long game was always that if the South were its own country, then as now, they would be a country at great disadvantage to the actual United States directly to their north, and that it would either precipitate a war. I mean, eventually, just the blockade around them. The U.S. Navy blockade around southern ports would start the war, or it would be basically an act of war. So, yeah, I mean, speed the collapse. We talk about stuff nowadays that feels a lot like speed the collapse, as though that's a political philosophy, and I guess it can be.
And sometimes it centers around secession, you know, like you'll see people on both sides being like, yeah, well, we just need to get rid of California or Florida or whatever.
Yeah. Or yeah, go, let's refight 1861.
Yeah.
But both Brooks and Butler did not live to see the Civil War that they may have precipitated.
Really?
Brooks, the real bad guy in our story, before Sumner even returned to his seat in the Senate, Brooks died of croup.
Croup? Adults got croup back then.
Yeah. And
died of kennel cough, R.I.P.
His death was described as absolutely horrific. They said that at the end he was tearing at his throat to get a breath. He basically...
I'm sure this is being reported gleefully in the northern papers, right?
Right. This is hard to not see as some kind of divine...
God is an abolitionist.
And then Butler got dropsy, which was, you know, terrible swelling of the limbs, and died of it in May of that year. So in 1857, just 1 year later, I mean, Brooks died of croup even, like, what? Not even a year later, nine months later.
Wouldn't that be crazy? Some news cycle like that is going on, and then, you know, whoever the center of it is, the George Santos-like figure, is just dead less than a year later.
And dies, like, in a horrific manner that can only be seen as God. You know, I'm sure that there were Quaker speeches given where it's like, we lament that God had to strangle this man.
Providential retribution.
with the world's worst sore throat.
Look, God's hands were tied.
The Civil War we can cover and have covered on other episodes of this show, so I won't get into that.
CF, the Civil War.
But Sumner went on to have a very illustrious career after the war, and although he was never fully recovered from his injuries, he was the senator most agitating for not just... So after Lincoln announced the Emancipation Proclamation, Sumner was very dissatisfied with it. He wanted Lincoln not just to free the slaves, but to grant them equality. Mm. And he saw all the deficiencies in the Emancipation Proclamation. And so he started to advocate for a civil rights bill. And he was the one that really was behind passing the 13th Amendment. And the 13th Amendment he was very dissatisfied with because...
Watered down.
It was watered down. He wanted the 13th Amendment to say that all citizens were equal before the law. And hilariously, the resistance to that was that senators said, whoa, if you take that to its logical conclusion, then women will be able to vote. And so they walked it way back. And so Sumner continued to advocate, well, not advocate, agitate, like real pain in the ass style agitation for a true civil rights amendment. Unfortunately, he died in 1874 at the age of 63 before he saw his civil rights bill passed, but kind of as a commemorate, you know, his body was lay in state in the rotunda, and as part of the kind of respect for him that came right around his death, his civil rights bill actually was passed in 1875. And he thought, and he regarded it as like the actual, to pass it would be to make Reconstruction real. Reconstruction up until that point, he saw as just a series of compromises that was slavery and everything but name only. Like if you didn't grant the full right to vote, the full, you know, right, like segregation was not going to be compatible with Reconstruction.
And he correctly predicted, I guess, the emergence of what turned into the Jim Crow South.
He did. And And a big part of what happened was that the Supreme Court in 1883 struck down his civil rights bill. And so he, you know, so what could have been the alternate universe of the United States was that Sumner lived long enough to not only see his civil rights bill implemented, but retained enough power
to see it enforced,
to see it as the law of the land. And that would have, I mean, it wasn't until 1964, 90 years later, that we finally passed effectively his civil rights bill and made it the law of the land.
He must have been such a powerful symbol as a living person, you know, not just because of his legislative power or his, you know, decades of principled, you know, rhetoric, and but also just because of his survival. You know, like, he had pulled through an act of violence perpetrated by slavers in the same way that the nation had. And, you know, I assume a lot of the veneration, you know, especially around his death, would have been hearkening back to what he, you know, his personal story of survival.
And the hardest thing for a lot of non-Americans to understand is that the Democratic Party at this point was the pro-slavery party.
Yes.
And the Republican Party really formed in this crucible. And the Republican Party was the party of abolition. Sumner was a major, major Republican Party figure.
The founder, like, an, you know, one of the really founders of the movement.
But he remained a very cantankerous figure in every aspect of American life. So even his fellow Massachusetts Republicans were like, ah, this guy with this civil rights haranguing, like, he comes into my office, he's such a pain in the ass, right?
Yeah.
And so it's one of the problems of being on the right side of history. If you really are a believer in your cause, you're not interested in making friends.
Yeah, you can't be a wheeler dealer.
And in not being interested in making friends, he often lost allies in those moments when, you know, he was one or two votes away from achieving an electoral victory.
So you're in favor of the middle way, moderate, milquetoast, New York Times op-ed guy who glad hands everybody and...
Well, this is the problem with democracy, right? You have to get... You either have to decide that democracy doesn't work and you're going to just enforce what is true and right, but the danger of that is that the other side believes it's true and right, and then you grant them that right to cane other people in order to convince them.
And you may doom your whole society.
Yeah. Yeah. So the idea that you have to convince people of the rightness of your cause is like the key thing that we can't describe as milquetoast, right? That is the thing that makes us, that separates us from the animals, Ken.
So instead of calling slavery a harlot.
I think you can still call slavery a harlot. You have to make a carve out for real harlots who we understand are hardworking, you know, sex workers.
I don't mean today. I just mean, like, what's the version of his speech that, you know, that is convincing instead of rabble-rousing?
Well, you know, I think at that point in time, there was no convincing,
yeah.
Right? At that point in time, it was just one of those moments in history where blood needed to be spilled. And that's a terrible thing to have to say, that there are times when, we're just going to have to kill 100,000 boys.
It is, because the implication is that might happen again.
Oh, you know? It will happen again, I'm afraid.
like, you don't want it to be in your lifetime when you say, well, I sure hope the civil society lasts. I hope my kids get to see it.
Yeah, it's a crazy thing to be living in a time when just sort of the basic ideas of how to get someone else to understand what you're saying are being regarded as, well, that's like the basic idea that you would try and convince someone rather than just force them to choke on your ideas is increasingly like so unfashionable and so hard to say to a young person, like, you can't, I know you're right, but if you don't feel some obligation to try and convince people that you're right. You just stand on your hard ground. You're just talking about a war, and a violent war, because that's because there is no like internet war. That's not going to solve it, right? It's going to end up being.
And if the other people are unconvincible, death. I mean, you can't.
What can you do?
What are you going to do about a flat earther?
I mean, the 100 Years' War lasted for 112 years.
You think we can beat that?
I think we can. I think we're on our way. Maybe if we trace this war back to 1856.
Yeah, we'll backdate it.
If it really started at the Kansas-Nebraska Act and we're still fighting it, sure. What are we at now?
I think we should end with another caning. We need to bookend the canings.
Who gets caned next, and who does the caning?
It's just like a pay-per-view match. You decide. It's like the guy who was a good sharpshooter and wanted to go up to Niagara. You just you pick your two guys and live caning on pay-per-view to decide the fate of the Republic.
Who would you put in the ring?
The problem is that everybody in the Senate is in their late 80s now. That's the problem.
You know what we need? We need the new caning has to be between two female members of the U.S.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for saying it.
Right? It needs to be Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and one of the kooky ones from...
Lauren Taylor Greene.
There you go.
Lauren Boebert or Marjorie Taylor Greene.
I think, oh boy, that would actually be...
Wait, this is very retrogressive. Yeah, you just want to see women fighting
with canes.
This doesn't make you a good ally.
That's never happened before.
Yeah, mud wrestling was bad.
Yeah, they can wear armor. It's not like a sexy thing.
But they need to have canes.
The harlot in this situation is the House of Representatives.
All right.
Not the members of the House of Representatives.
Well, I'll alert the gutta percha factories. And that concludes The Caning of Charles Sumner, entry 180.PR2314, certificate number 46616, in the omnibus. Nowadays, most of our ritualistic canings take place on social media. You could find us there at some point at Ken Jennings, at John Roderick, at Omnibus Project. You could email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. Send actual physical correspondence. Send us your gutta percha cane handles to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. To ensure that good institutions survive the coming blood wave, you can support all the aims and good work done by the Omnibus Project by going to patreon.com/omnibusproject. And lending your support. I don't know why you would put that off. If you've been considering it, today is the day you could have 50-something new episodes of The Omnibus drop into your lap just by joining even the lowest donation tier at patreon.com/omnibusproject.
Well, and also, I mean, my goodness, I understand what it's like to listen to somebody day in and day out saying, subscribe to my Patreon, and to think, not today, Satan. Not me. This doesn't apply to me. But then there is that day when you go, this does apply to me. This is speaking to me. I'm going to take a stand today and join the Omnibus Patreon.
Because, you know, ask not for whom the bell tolls, and we're all part of the same swelling mane and all that.
Oh, yeah.
This is an exhortation to you as well. A second ago, I was talking to 10,000 other people. But now I'm talking to you. That's right. You're looking around, but I do mean you.
Ken Jennings.
Sitting or standing right there.
Talking to you.
Personally.
Right now. you can email your friends and say, guess who I was talking to? Ken Jennings. Guess what he told me to do?
He told me to donate to his Patreon. Of all the things he could have inspired me to do, really? That was it? He used his moment to plug his Patreon? Isn't he doing okay? Patreon.com/omnibusproject and find the Futurelings online in their various Facebook groups, subreddits,
Hi Futurelings,
Discords, wherever they congregate. Like potato bugs. You move aside a rock and a bunch of Futurelings duck for cover. They're everywhere.
Yeah, it's like when you go into your closet and you realize that the marmorated stink bugs have come in for the winter and they're all hiding in the pockets of your jackets.
Join the marmorated Futurelings. I've been killing them.
Good man. How do you kill them?
You can squish them.
You squish them?
Yeah. Oh, because of the smell.
I send them down the toilet.
I'm not such a panty waste. I don't care if they smell for a second.
I collect them in the toilet, cover them with toilet paper, and then flush the whole gang. And what I don't know is how long they can survive underwater in a sewage treatment plant. It may be that they get down there and they're like, this is amazing.
On your tour of the sewage treatment plant, you didn't ask how long the marmorated stink bugs survive?
No, I was too busy looking at water bears under a microscope. Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, before the Great War, or depending on how you look at it, maybe before the end of the Great War, we have no idea how long our civilization survived, or whether you, in the future, even regard it as a civilization. I'm guessing you do. It's undeniable. We have an electric grid. We have a shared language.
We have trains and stuff.
Yeah, we're a civilization. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. If Providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese, and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.